Hi everyone, welcome to the podcast. Today we're talking to Owen Evans, who is at Oxford's Future of Humanity Institute. Owen's interested in studying techniques that would allow machines to learn about human preferences and values based on their interactions with human beings. Now that work is quite complex, and it integrates knowledge from machine learning, cognitive science, and even analytic philosophy. And it's an area Owen's been working on since well before deep learning was even popularized. But one area where Owen's done a lot of work, and that we'll be talking about a fair bit here, is the question of AGI timelines, predicting key milestones on the road to artificial general intelligence. Now, this is obviously an important area because predictions about AGI timelines also inform what kinds of actions we take today in anticipation of hitting those various milestones. If we knew with confidence that artificial general intelligence was just around the corner, that would immediately imply certain actions on both the policy side and the AI safety side that we might not take otherwise. And likewise, if we thought that AI timelines might be longer, it might make sense to invest more in policy and in capabilities research at this stage and not worry so much about existential risk or any of the other things that might accompany a late stage AGI scenario. So we'll be diving into a lot of questions around AI timelines and the implications that those have for policy research and AI safety as well. I really enjoyed the conversation. I hope you do too. Well, hi, Owen. Thanks so much for joining me for the podcast.
It's great to be here.
Well, really happy to have you. You're one of a number of people working on AI safety, AI alignment, AI policy, but you're also, I think, the only person I've spoken to so far who's done a lot of work in both AI alignment and AI policy. So I think there's a lot of interesting stuff we can get into about the intersection between those two spaces. I think there's a lot of interesting interaction there. But before we get into that, can I just ask, like, how did you discover this space to begin with?
Yeah, so I took a winding road, I guess. I was interested in AI in high school. I read Steven Pinker's How the Mind Works and Douglas Hofstadter and some of Ray Kurzweil's writings on this. And I thought AI is going to be a huge deal in the future, in my lifetime, basically because the mind is computational and Moore's Law is going to mean that there's more and more compute. So I wondered why people weren't taking this more seriously, especially in academia. And so I thought I'll study mathematics and psychology and philosophy, and this will help me like get more of a grasp on the issue. So that's what I did. And fast forward to grad school, I was at MIT and I walked into a class that Josh Tenenbaum was giving on computational cognitive science. And so this is the idea of using techniques from statistics and machine learning to understand higher cognition. And this may seem like an obvious idea now that you'd use like AI to try and understand human language. But I think it was definitely less, sort of less like well-known back then that there were these connections.
What year would that have been?
So this would be like 2010.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I took this class with Tenenbaum and I found this combination, like human cognition on the one hand and AI on the other, to be really captivating. And I ended up doing, working on a couple of papers with Josh Tenenbaum and his students on computational cognitive science. And at the same time, I was still really interested in these long-term questions about AI and human-level AI. So I took some time out from MIT and went to be a visitor at the Future of Humanity Institute in Oxford University, where Nick Bostrom was at the time working on superintelligence, so writing that book. And that was also a great environment to learn and think about AI. And when I went back to MIT to finish my PhD, I decided I'll focus more on the machine learning side rather than the cognitive science and the sort of human mind, human brain side. And so I finished up at MIT and then returned to Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford as a postdoc. And I had the opportunity to work on alignment. And in particular, sort of combining, you know, the alignment issues raised in superintelligence with machine learning. So trying to align machine learning systems.
It's interesting how much of an important role the Future of Humanity Institute's played in the history of so many people in this space. And Nick Bostrom's
book was a big part of that, of course. But since then, we've seen a lot of other organizations emerge as well, many of which you've played an important role in too. So could you provide a bit of an overview then of sort of zooming out from Future of Humanity Institute? What's the ecosystem of AI policy and AI alignment organizations that currently exist?
Yeah, so they're spread across different sectors. So you've got academia, sort of nonprofits that are independent, and then industry or companies. So within academia, there's the Future of Humanity Institute, which I've already mentioned, doing both sort of technical alignment research, machine learning style, and policy work. And then there is a group chart called CHAI, Center for Human Compatible AI, where I was actually a visiting scholar a couple of years ago. That's headed by Stuart Russell and is based at UC Berkeley. Jacob Steinhardt is a researcher who also has a group at UC Berkeley doing really interesting research. And so that's focused on the sort of technical AI side rather than policy. And then outside of academia, but in the nonprofit space, there's the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, which has been going also for a while, like the Future of Humanity Institute. And they're really focused on the theoretical foundations of AI and of sort of aligned AI. So that's a more mathematical approach. There's the Open Philanthropy Project, which is both funding research in this area. So they're effectively a sort of nonprofit organization funding research in this area and also carrying out their own in-house research, in particular at the moment on sort of AI timelines and how long we might expect different milestones to take in AI. So there's interesting research coming out there. In terms of industry and tech companies, there's OpenAI, which people probably know about. It's doing really exciting research like GPT-3, but it also has a pretty big initiative on safety and alignment. So there are groups working on alignment, on transparency, safe reinforcement learning, also policy and forecasting of AI. And then DeepMind, which is another major player in doing like the sort of mainstream of AI research, but they also have an alignment team working on sort of long-term issues and safety, and there are teams working on machine learning security there and also the policy side and ethics. So they've also had a pretty, although everything's kind of new, right? DeepMind have been involved in safety research for a while and collaborate with Oxford on some of that.
Yeah, one of the things I find so interesting about the space is that what you think about AGI timelines is going to be a big factor in determining what you'll work on in the short term, AI policy-wise or AI alignment-wise. And organizations that tend to have shorter timelines will tend to focus more on, say, pressing safety and alignment issues. Organizations with longer timelines, maybe on other things. Each of these organizations is working on what they're working on because they have a specific view about AGI timelines and the likelihood that AGI will appear in the next 5, 10, 30 years. What do you know of the different theses that those organizations are bringing to the table, and how does that play into what they're working on?
Yeah, so I think that's right. I think that the theses that the organizations have do play a role in the kind of research that they're doing on alignment. I think probably the basic distinction is if you take seriously the view that current systems, if you scale them up enough, could lead to AGI, then you'll tend to have shorter timelines. Probably because you don't think we need some fundamental conceptual breakthrough. And you'll also maybe think of alignment research as more urgent and more feasible. We can study our current systems, and you think that sort of future AGI systems are going to just be scaled up versions of those. Whereas if you think we need conceptual breakthroughs in order to achieve AGI, then you'll think probably this might come a lot later because we'll need to have those breakthroughs first. And secondly, it might be quite hard to study alignment today because we don't know what kind of system we're going to need to align. And I think, you know, I think I'm wary of attributing, you know, very particular views to whole organizations that contain many individuals.
It's sort of interesting just how much variance there is there. Do you have a personal opinion regarding timelines?
I mean, I think you should be sort of Bayesian and probabilistic. And I think there's uncertainty on either end, right? That is that there is some probability of things happening fairly soon. And there's some probability that really takes a long time and that current techniques sort of asymptote. So I don't want to put a number on it, but I think that even if there's only a 5% chance of AI occurring soon, say in the next 20 years, I think that's still a huge deal. That's still something that you should take really seriously. And so when thinking about how much alignment research to do, again, I think even if the probability of achieving AGI soon is fairly low, it still might be a good bet to do more research on this, to just give us a better understanding of what are the possible problems with alignment and how can we start to tackle them.
And do you sense a general shift? Maybe I'm wrong, but my sense has been with the advent of GPT-3, there's been a general shift in the direction of taking neural networks and backpropagation as a path to AGI a little more seriously. Did GPT-3 in any way change your perspective, or GPT-2, or any of the scaling results that OpenAI is seeing?
I think GPT 2 and 3 changed my perspective a bit. I think that there were already good arguments and good evidence that you could really achieve a lot just by scaling up models, just by creating bigger neural networks, training them for longer on bigger data sets. But I think that the performance from GPT-2 and GPT-3 has just been somewhat more impressive than I would have expected. I think the models have been better at sort of mastering this whole sort of range of skills. So there's the sort of meta learning aspect or few shot learning, and then being able to do basic mathematics or really basic arithmetic, and then just the sort of breadth of knowledge that the system seems to have absorbed, both about sort of human language and, you know, how to construct nice sentences, but also sort of factual knowledge. I think it's not been a sort of complete shock, because I was following the field pretty closely, and language models were already doing very impressive things before GPT-2 and GPT-3. But I think it definitely was, you know, surprising just how much they could do.
Yeah, I'm actually, one of the biggest surprises for me was actually the reaction of different people in the community to GPT-3, just how polarizing it was as a development. Some people seem to be saying, oh, this is, you know, we have AGI, this is proto-AGI. And other people were saying, you know, this is so so limited in its capacity, it's overfitting like crazy. People seem to be perfectly divided in terms of being utterly shocked or totally unsurprised and still just as skeptical. Part of the challenge here is we don't necessarily have the ability to evaluate generalization ability. It's like kind of a new field in terms of model evaluation, because we've had so much narrow AI work on evaluation, but not necessarily with a more general system. Do you have any thoughts on that aspect of things? Like, how do we define this ability to generalize? In other words, what are we really debating even when we talk about AGI?
Yeah, those are great questions. So I think, we see with GPT-3 that it does very well on the traditional benchmarks for NLP tasks. So we can see by various concrete metrics that it is an improvement on previous models. And then we can sort of invent, as they do, invent new tasks and see how well it does on those and see that there's impressive performance, for example, on arithmetic and on like analogies and using novel words. But that's different from a really systematic test for generalization. So this will be an important area for new research. François Chollet, the guy who developed Keras, developed a sort of benchmark, like a suite of tasks that try to get at this more sort of general notion of rich conceptual generalization. You know, that so the tasks are a bit like, flavored a little bit like Raven's matrices or IQ tests. And that was just the first step in that direction. Mm-hmm. But I think trying to do more work, which is, you know, challenging research work, but where you're testing that kind of generalization, that does seem promising. And with GPT-3, you could have a version of that that's more focused on language or like phrasing things in language. But another measure is economic, right? So OpenAI has created this GPT-3 API, and lots of companies will be exploring whether they can use GPT-3. And so to some degree, I think we'll see whether, like, is the system flexible enough that it can deal with like real world challenges and actually improve companies' metrics? And so I think that's sort of harder to assess like in an academic paper, but I think that will be an interesting area to find out, like, does this have the kind of robustness that leads to real world improvements in performance?
Yeah, it's really interesting because we have a hard enough time predicting the performance of things for which we have clear metrics already. And now, you know, predicting generalization ability, something we don't even know how to articulate what that means at this stage, seems like a really special challenge. And in that vein, you actually put together a piece of work that was published in 2018, where you did some polling of AI experts. I think the polls, as we were talking earlier, you mentioned the polls were conducted in 2016. But I did just want to read out a quick excerpt, a couple sentences from it, because I thought they were really interesting. So this is from the abstract. You just write, researchers predict AI will outperform humans in many activities in the next 10 years, such as translating languages by 2024, writing high school essays by 2026, driving a truck by 2027, working in retail by 2031, writing a best-selling book by 2049, and working as a surgeon by 2053. And I think what's really interesting is, in retrospect, again, this was work done like 4 years ago, debatably, we've already started hitting or at least flirting with a number of these milestones. It's not clear whether like language translation, for example, is quite there, or truck driving, but have you noticed patterns in the kinds of things we've been accomplishing faster than we expected, or maybe the kinds of predictive errors people have been making, even if they're experts in the space?
Yeah, so right, we're coming up to 4.5 years or 5 years after the original survey was done. And so, yeah, I think we can start to get some information about the, you know, what did these kind of forecasts do well on? What did they do less well on? As you said, I think translation has progressed faster than people expected. So they predicted that it would take 7.5 years to reach, for AI to reach amateur level translation, so not professional translators.
Wow.
And I think that, so today, after 4 to 5 years, I think we're at that level, even for tricky languages, that, you know, harder languages to translate. They predicted that beating humans at all the Atari games would take 9 years. And I think we're there as well after 4 years, 4 or 5 years. And then writing a high school essay, I think, you know, GPT-3 or maybe like GPT-4 is going to be there, you know, more like 5 years or 6 years rather than 10 years, which they predicted. So those are some areas where they were sort of more pessimistic about AI progress. It's worth noting that these are median estimates. So people were actually giving probabilities for when this would happen. And so, for example, so when they said that the high school essay would take 10 years, they actually gave a 25% probability that it would be achieved by now, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a 1 in 4 chance that it would have happened after 5 years, and then a 50% chance that it would happen after 10 years. And so you expect some of those 1 in 4 events to occur. So I think, like, on the whole, their predictions look fairly reasonable. The things they said were really unlikely. For example, AI writes a New York Times bestseller, AI wins the Putnam mathematics competition. None of those things have happened. And the things that they said were really likely, you know, some of those have happened. So they sort of got some of those right. So I think the general patterns are that tasks involving language have gone quicker than expected. Some robotics tasks have maybe been slightly slower than expected. Mm. If there's a lesson, it's partly the scaling hypothesis, or the idea that if you can really scale up your models and scale up the data to train them, then you can make progress fairly quickly. And if you don't have that, as you don't in robotics, you just don't have the same cheap, like, abundance of data or training examples. And so that's gone a bit slower.
Yeah, it's really cool to see those different divergences. One thing you brought up there was, so the New York Times bestseller being a really hard task that hasn't been accomplished yet. This may be an impossible question to answer, but it might be one that's fun to kind of bat around a little bit. What do you think is currently standing in the way of going from really powerful language models that can do all kinds of generalization tasks, translate languages, and so on? What's between that and getting to the point where we have a New York Times bestseller written by an AI?
I mean, I think that probably the most direct approach is just to scale up the current models that we have. So in terms of how to get there, I expect that the most promising approach is to work on scaling, which means finding out, like, how to build even bigger models than, say, GPT-3, and generating larger data sets for them. Also, higher quality data sets could help. Exploring architectures, especially to the degree that architectures lend themselves to leveraging compute. So I think that's a lot of what will happen in terms of how we get better performance. In terms of sort of what can systems like GPT-3 not do very well, or like what seem like the current limitations, I think the biggest gap between GPT-3 and humans is probably in basically like how long range the dependencies are, or sort of what time duration the models are acting over. So if someone writes a New York Times bestseller, they probably spend a few years writing that book. And all the work that they're doing over that time is contributing to this one output. And so they might write some notes one day and then 6 months later, like, revisit those notes and expand upon that, right? Whereas GPT-3 reads something like 500 words and then it produces some output. And everything it does depends on those 500 words and nothing else, right? So if you try to generate a novel with it, after it's generated 5,000 words, it will only be sort of paying attention to the last 500 words it's written, right? So all the other stuff before is completely, like, out of its mind, as it were. This is just a huge difference between, like, most kind of really sophisticated human work, like doing mathematics, and what our machine learning models, the way our machine learning models operate today. So I think, like, if people are looking to scale up architectures, I think they'll be thinking about longer range dependencies, like being able to, when you're producing the next 100 words, you're not just looking at the previous 500, but in some sense, you have a representation of, like, a whole book of context.
It's interesting that the answer you gave to that question was very applied and very, very practical. Like, you know, what is standing in the way of GPT-3 getting to the New York Times bestseller point? And you're like, okay, you know, compute, this, that, all these things that you could imagine being deployed by industry within a couple of years or even months. And then the conceptual side was sort of the lagging piece of that, which is almost backwards from the way typical scientific discoveries happen. I mean, usually people have to come up with a theory, they have to understand what it is they're building, and then they make a plan to build that thing. It kind of seems in this space like there's at least a prospect of building something before we expect to have built it ourselves. The very people who are building these powerful systems might not have a clue that they're building something that will turn out to be nearly as powerful as it is. Is that a risk on the AI safety side of things? Like, is there a real prospect of having a team that builds something that's maybe, you know, more than they could, biting off more than they can chew in terms of what they put together?
I think that progress is still fairly incremental. So I think that's important to keep in mind. Right, before GPT-3, obviously there was GPT-2, but there was also a sequence of larger models than GPT-2 that came out and that also had pretty impressive performance. Those were from other companies like Google and Microsoft. You know, there's a big community producing AI systems and making a system that's a little bit better than other people's, right, is advantageous. And so I think that, you know, when there's a big discovery or big advance like GPT-3 that gets people excited, I think you'll have more, you will tend to have more groups moving into that space. And then you'll see this sort of incremental progress in that area. So I think that people who are like really paying attention to what's going on in the field and following the latest developments, they'll see a sort of more incremental path. Mm-hmm. And so would be sort of less surprised by developments. At the same time, I think attempts to sort of forecast what kind of capabilities are possible with a particular like architecture, I think have just not been successful. So some people have said, you know, we won't be able to do meta learning, or we won't be, or few shot learning, without having kind of richer models than just transformers or just RNNs. I think those predictions just have a bad track record, right? So many people have said, look, deep learning is not enough. You need to combine it with symbolic AI, or you need like richer architectures that involve like writable memories or Bayesian neural networks like Bayesian uncertainty. And I think very simple neural nets scaled up enough with the right like long training time and big training data have just shown an ability to do an amazing array of things that people didn't think, you know, many people have said wouldn't be possible. So I think in that sense, you're right that there can be surprises in what fairly simple techniques scaled up can actually achieve.
And I guess there's a naive argument that I'd be curious to hear actually from you what the most common counter arguments to this very naive position would be, because I think they'll be illustrative, but neural networks are universal function approximators. So the moment you say that, there in principle is no function that they can't approximate. And to the extent that cognition or even consciousness is a function, then they should be able to emulate it at some scale for some configuration. What are the main counter arguments to that position? That obviously would be the canonical kind of bullish case for deep learning. What's the sort of symbolic neural net argument or some of the other arguments up there?
Yeah, so I think the universal approximation arguments or universality arguments, and they just say that it's possible that there exists a neural net that can represent any function. And I think the original constructions, so how they show that it's possible is an extremely inefficient encoding, right? So you'd have a neural net, but it would be this completely enormous, impractically enormous representation of the function. And so what we're really interested in theoretically is whether there's a sufficiently small neural net that could capture this function, right? Small enough that we could actually train this neural net on some actual data. It would actually like fit on our compute resources. And so, you know, if you needed more compute than the, you know, than is possible in the universe or is just possible on Earth, right? It doesn't really matter if there's this like theoretical possibility. I think the mere existence of these neural nets and the flexibility that they have in theory doesn't really say that much. And that's why the field, although they knew people in machine learning knew about these approximate universality results, I think in the late 80s or early 90s. It wasn't the case that everyone moved into neural nets because they did not know whether you could actually find a small enough neural net that had this capability.
Yeah, I mean, it always interesting to think about the constraints. One other area I did want to ask you about was technical AI safety and AI alignment research specifically, since that's something you're working on as well. It's common to hear AI safety researchers say that alignment is a very hard problem, but they often present different reasons for that hardness. What do you consider to be the most challenging part of solving the technical alignment problem?
Yeah, so I think in a sense, we don't know how hard the problem is because people haven't worked on it for that long. Not that many hours have been put into this problem if you compare it to like many problems in computer science that have been solved. So I think time will tell like how difficult it turns out to be. In terms of what is the biggest difficulty, and that's a difficult question. I think that at some meta level, a challenging thing is that machine learning research is quite empirical. So usually the way you make progress is by running experiments and seeing how well different models actually do on fairly like real world tasks, like classifying objects and images or translating languages. And it's hard to do very much work in machine learning that is purely theoretical and make a lot of progress. When it comes to alignment, we can't really do the same thing because we don't have systems today where it's sort of crucial that we align them, otherwise they're gonna do a lot of harm. And so we can do sort of small scale experiments that try and shed light on that question, or we can do theory. But I think we don't know, you know, how exactly that research will translate into actually solving the real problem that we need to solve. So I think at the meta level, like that's what makes it difficult. And that's part of why there's not more alignment research, I think, because yeah, the sort of main, most profitable methodology or most useful methodology in machine learning is this more empirical approach where you actually, like if you wanna show that you can improve computer vision, then you actually improve results on a real world like vision task, like ImageNet.
Yeah, and I guess one of the things that plays into this too is the current limitations in the abilities of some of our AI systems. Like they just can't do, as you were saying, they're not powerful enough that they need to be aligned. One thing I've been wondering about recently is the possibility that as the abilities of our systems increase, our ability to squeeze out more value from these AI systems is going to start depending on our ability to align them. So there's almost in some sense an economic incentive that will develop for alignment research more organically. Is that something that you see as a plausible way that we could end up with safe systems without putting conscious effort into setting up the landscape ahead of time? Not that I'm advocating not doing that. I'm just sort of as a curiosity.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. So I think the good future scenario for alignment is one where it is very hard to make a system that's economically useful that is not without confronting the alignment problem. That would be a good situation, right? Where there's really no incentive to not take alignment seriously because you can't make money out of your AI unless you put in serious work on alignment. So I think there's some reasonable chance that turns out to be the case. And in that world, I think things are likely to go better with alignment. Then I think there's also some probability that that's not the case, that it's a sort of more messy situation. And the scenario I'd imagine there is that there are, you know, proxies, there are reward functions or objectives that you can train on that make your system like reasonably aligned. Mm-hmm. And in the short term, you can do really well by running AI systems with those proxies. It's only maybe over time that the misalignment becomes more problematic. And then by that point, it's sort of hard to, it's like hard to change the system. There's maybe, yeah, a lot of like a lot of momentum behind that system, maybe financial momentum. So I think that, you know, we have maybe some very mild form of this today, where there are, say, like recommendation algorithms that are somewhat, they're pretty aligned with the users. So they usually would, you know, show the users interesting content, but they're also, they're really optimizing for sort of engagement or how much time people spend on the system. And that's misaligned with the users to some degree, because the users don't want to get addicted to using the service or spend loads of their time, you know, watching silly videos. And so there's also some problem there, but the system makes a lot of money for the companies. So when they're thinking, oh, should we just like get rid of our system and build a more aligned one? There's like a financial interest in sticking with the current system.
Yeah, and I've heard similar arguments brought to bear with respect to political polarization on social media too, where, you know, the algorithms just do better if they can change the user to make them more polarized so that the problem's dimensionality is reduced and you're more likely to correctly, you know, predict what the next ad is or the next post is that'll get clicks. One of the philosophically interesting dimensions of this as well, especially when viewed through that lens of polarization, is I can imagine the average polarized person who today is only polarized because they've been on Twitter for the last 10 years and gradually they've kind of adiabatically moved into this highly polar position. That person may very well today say, look, you're telling me that Twitter, the recommendation algorithm, is misaligned. I'm here to tell you that my beliefs today feel very, very aligned. In other words, I'm glad I ended up polarized in the way that I did. It's the past version of me that had all these faults, and I'm glad I was broken of them. In a way, almost like, you know, your average member of a cult will think, thank goodness I met the cult leader. They, you know, they were ultimately aligned with what I am now, not what I used to be. It kind of seems like there's a lot of fuzziness in that distinction between past selves and future selves, because we are destined to change. Our moral norms are destined to become almost like irreconcilably different from our moral norms of the past. Maybe that's an unsolvable problem, but how are you thinking about that that aspect of this issue?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. First of all, I think it's unclear how much political polarization can be explained by social media.
Right.
I think there's more polarization in, say, older generations who use social media less. So I think that it's a complicated social science, you know, argument and story to try and attribute changes in society to technology, and specifically AI technology, right? It might be that Twitter would have the same effect whether or not there was any AI involved. Mm-hmm. So I think we want to be careful about those questions. But in terms of AI, the AI system sort of shifting people's preferences over time, or at least people, you know, being happy with where they end up, even if there was, even if they weren't sort of aware of the process. I think maybe there's some possibility of that. I think people currently have quite a lot of awareness of the sort of downsides of using some of these technologies. And I think there'll always be people who don't use them very much, right? Who stay away, who will have some different perspective. I think in general, humans are quite robust to various kinds of, you know, new technologies, new experiences. So people worried a lot about like radio and television and video games and movies. And I think that in many ways, like society continued to function fine and maybe better than ever. So I think there will be defense mechanisms against some of these, like say addictive content or polarizing content, that also use AI to sort of help people like filter out the kind of systems that will actually be better for them. In the long run, it is important to have these, I guess, people with some external perspective. You know, if you thought that an AI system was really going to be distorting how people think about the world in ways that were hard for those individuals to really maintain an awareness of, then I agree that that could be an important issue. I think we're some way away from that scenario, but it is worth thinking about and interesting.
Yeah, I guess so many intersections between philosophy, ethics, and this stuff. You almost have to know more than any human possibly could to work your way through this. Great. Well, one last thing I want to ask you on the technical alignment side was this theme of IDA, which is an alignment strategy that's become pretty popular. I wanted to ask you about this because I know you've done some work on it in the past. I know it's not currently a focus, but would you mind explaining what IDA is and how it works?
So IDA stands for Iterated Distillation and Amplification. And IDA is a scheme for training an AI in a way that's aligned and makes it aligned and that can go beyond human level. The idea is very simple. So you first train a model to imitate a human. And then you train a second model to imitate the human who has access to the first model, so is able to make calls to the first model. Then you train a third model that imitates the human with access to the second model, and so on, right? So the next generation of the model is always trained on imitating the human with access to the previous model. So the key idea is that using the previous generation of the model can help the human to perform better on the task. And that's how you get a sort of bootstrapping improvement over time, which can take you to beyond human level. So to be more concrete, imagine that the model is like a kind of AI assistant, right? It's being trained to imitate the human. And so it's like, if I can use the model, it's as if I can use a sort of fairly smart assistant to help me do a task. So you imagine some future version of GPT-3, like GPT-5. Imagine I'm doing like science problems, say university level science problems. If I could ask questions to GPT-5, that could probably help me answer harder questions than I'd be able to on my own. Mm-hmm. And especially if you imagine asking like hundreds of questions to GPT-5, as part of me trying to answer one question, that would sort of amplify my ability to answer questions. That's what enables you sort of in principle to ultimately train a system that does better than just a human on their own. So to sort of surpass human level, not just on speed, but on the sort of quality, like sophistication of the system.
And the alignment here comes from that sort of human oversight or the simulated human oversight at each stage that...
Right. So there's two questions. Does it reach beyond human level? And is it aligned? I think the way to think about why is IDA aligned is a sort of mathematical induction style argument. So initially, the first step was a model is it trained to imitate a human. And so we can assume that that's aligned because it's just imitating what humans do. And then at the next stage, the model is imitating a human with access to the previous model. Well, the human and the previous model, they're both aligned. So the combination of them should be aligned. And so if you train to imitate that, you should get something that's aligned. And then you just continue the argument as you iterate.
Is that argument, because when I first encountered it, I guess I was initially skeptical. That was my default here. It feels like a strong assumption. It feels like the kind of thing that sounds right, but when you actually inspect it, might fall apart. You know, if I train an AI to mimic me and then assume that on successfully training that AI, it will be aligned with me, that seems to almost beg the question of alignment entirely. Like if I could make an AI that replicated me exactly and was faithful to my moral compass, then that almost seems like it presupposes a solution to the alignment problem. I don't know if that's a fair assessment though.
Well, I think that, I think the alignment problem really has two parts. One is, right, the system should be trying to act in a way that the human wants it to do so, right? And maybe in some context, just imitating the human would satisfy that, right? I'd be happy if it just did what I would do in the situation. But the second part is being competitive with alternative ways of training a system that might not be aligned. So you know, if you imagine someone trains a system just to opt to maximize profit. So there's an AI system that's making decisions in a company, it's just optimizing profit. So that system can go beyond human level. It can come up with strategies that no human has ever come up with to maximize profit, just as AlphaGo came up with strategies that no human invented to play Go. So if that system was up against another AI that just imitated humans, it could win because the human can never come up with these strategies. The AI that just imitates can never come up with strategies that are beyond human level. So I think we need to not just build aligned systems, but aligned systems that can really compete on an even playing field with systems trained in other ways that might not be aligned. And if you can only imitate a human, there's like a quite limited range of things you can do in a way. So having said that, it's definitely not the case that just imitating a human is a completely straightforward just in terms of alignment. So, you know, you might be worried about how robust is the system that you get out of, you know, that you get out of this process. So you can imagine training to imitate a human on some set of training examples, and the system does very well and matches the human. And then you have a distribution shift. So you're now considering a weird scenario that the system hasn't seen anything like that before. And it might behave in a way that the human would not, right? So it might be unreliable, out of distribution, issues around inner alignment, or inner optimizers, are sort of relevant to this question. So I think adversarial examples that people are probably familiar with, another case where you sort of train the system to imitate a human's labels, but then out of distribution, it behaves very differently than humans would. And we might care about that scenario. So the argument I gave for imitation, for IDA being aligned was a very simple sort of the first step that you need to consider. And there's definitely a lot more subtlety. Yeah.
Yeah, actually a lot more to unpack than we can probably squeeze into this podcast, but I appreciate the overview. Actually, I think it's useful for people who are just trying to get oriented in the space, especially given the attention that that IDA has been getting. Well, thanks so much for sharing your insights on all this stuff. Is there anywhere people can follow you on social media or follow your work?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter, which is... it's my full name and then _UK. So Owen Evans _UK. Yeah, people can also check out my website. If you just Google for me, or I guess you can put the URL up. So all my papers are up.
Yeah, I can include all those links in the blog post that'll accompany the podcast too. So people can check those out for sure. Well, Owen, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. And thanks for a great conversation.
Thanks. It's been really interesting.